Mackenzie.
Lamar.
We are talking about Miss Molly Bloom today and the games, mm-hmm. the games that she plays and such. She seems very competitive at basically everything she does, from Olympic skiing to managing poker games to being in courtrooms. I don't know what the third example is, but I wanted to open up today and ask you, what are you most competitive at?
I feel like this will maybe not be a surprise, but I relate deeply to Molly Bloom because I am competitive at everything, basically fucking everything. I have to be the best at everything. I am definitely guilty of, like, I don't want to do things that I'm not good at because I'm too competitive at them. Like, it's not fun for me anymore. There are a couple notable exceptions, but generally speaking, like, I was a competitive swimmer. I did a bunch of other, like, competitive things as a kid. Even, like, choir and theater I would go to competition for, right? Like, we weren't just singing and dancing for funsies. We had to win something, right? I think pretty much. And then at work, I mean, you know me at work, so probably enough said. Very competitive, for sure.
You should have you heard you? Nowadays? I feel like you would love it nowadays because everybody gets a trophy, so you would be guaranteed to get something every time you compete.
I'm that person who would be pissed because I would be like, I won first and I want to be the only person with, listen, three trophies is good. I'm very cool with the three trophies, but they can have a ribbon. Let's give them a ribbon. You know, I'm not saying just
participation ribbon, participation not a ribbon. Trophy. Yeah. I'm with you. I think I relate to a lot. I feel very seen because I think I'm equally, have traditionally been a very competitive person. I think anybody who knows me can tell you that. I've toned it down in recent years, but I still really like to win. I won't get as rambunctious about it, but I am always trying to win. I think lately it's been a lot of trivia or like board games, like the nerdiest things you can be competitive at. Those are the things that I'm currently competitive at.
I will say, nugget for our listeners, this was something it took me a minute actually to learn about Lamar. I actually have learned that about you as we have gotten to know each other over the last couple of years, because I definitely read you differently at first. And then I slowly figured out, like, oh, okay. Yeah, no, this is a competition. And like you said, like board games, nerdy things. For example, guys, I got a drink with Lamar after work yesterday and I was given a puzzle. So I literally had to solve a puzzle.
Don't make me sound like a six-year-old. This is not like a piece of, like a puzzle. Like, this is a logic puzzle, different type.
Still, it's still a puzzle. And you still literally gave me homework to have a margarita with you. So I'm just, this is Lamar. Anyway, so we're all on the same team here. We're all
make
very
it sound like I was like, he'll Mackenzie do a puzzle with me. All right, let's get into it.
All right. Well, hello, folks. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
Today, we are continuing Inaugure April with a fun one that Lamar hasn't seen, Molly's Game. But, fun fact, you know who has seen it? Our special guest, Kelsey. Welcome, yay, Kelsey, to the pod.
What's happening?
Oh, my God. We are so excited you're here. Okay, so for those of you fine listeners who don't know, we all work together. Basically, all of our friends are from work, apparently, is what we've learned. But anyway, Kelsey is my former boss and colleague now, who we love and adore, and is also a bit of a movie nerd. And fun fact, won his entrance fee to the pod by bidding on an auction. So you too can win.
Yeah. How much did you actually spend on the auction, Kelsey?
You know, I don't want to brag. I don't want to start off with a brag. You know, it's not about the size of the pot. It's about kind of getting in there just to play.
You're being very player X right now. But so I wanted to point out that you can bid for the right to appear on the show. We also still, Mackenzie, haven't sold any of those $200 koozies.
Yeah, $200 koozies up for grabs. Yeah.
If you can't swing those, you might just be able to get a guest appearance on the pod instead.
Yeah, and it does. It goes to charity. We'll pick a charity and we'll let you know. But yeah, bid to come on the pod. But Kelsey won the first round, so we're thrilled to have you. We're going to get into all the things that Kelsey knows about this movie and loves. He's super prepped. We're going to beat up on Lamar because we've both seen this movie a bunch. But before we get into all that, what are we drinking? Lamar, well,
we are drinking. You guys know I've been experimenting. I'm really trying to get better at this thing, and I have made some terrible drinks in the last couple months as I got into this new hobby. But this one I'm actually pretty proud of, so I'm calling it the buy-in because this is a poker movie.
Oh,
and
God, look
it's
at you.
Essentially, yeah, 1.5 ounces of bourbon, 1 ounce of ginger liqueur, which I didn't even know was a thing until last week. A half ounce of lemon juice and a little teeny bit of peach puree. So it's kind of like a spin on a Gold Rush with a gingery peach aftertaste, and it is delicious.
Love it. What are you having, Kelsey?
Oh, man. I am, again, just so excited to be here. I wanted to respect the spirit of watching the movie and coming prepared for that, but I know this isn't just about watching movies, so I wanted to also respect the drink game. So I came prepared. A little bit of a non-alcoholic bevy tonight. I got myself a non-alcoholic Austin local brand, Slow Luck, big fan. It's got kind of a tequila-y taste to it, which I enjoy. And then mixed with that, I have myself a social tonic, Hi-Yo. It's a fun little social drink that you can mix in with other non-alcoholic spirits. So yeah, I'm excited to be drinking and chatting movies with y'all tonight.
See, that sounds delicious. Yeah,
I love that a non-alcoholic tequila exists. That is so cool.
You know, and it's a weeknight, fellas. Like it's totally reasonable to not have to go hard on the Gold Rushes on a Wednesday. But that's super cool. I was funny. You were telling me about this earlier and I was looking it up, and I think that's a really fun brand. I'm going to have to check it out. Maybe they'll sponsor us. Lamar, we're going to get someday. I promise. I know we will. I'm working on it.
I've offered to sponsor my homemade underwear line on our podcast, like off the air several times, and you won't let me. So.
Well, that is definitely not allowed. These were not the sponsorships I was looking for.
It's Calvin's by Lamar. I just take Calvin Klein's and cross the name. It's Lamar Klein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very original. I love it. Well, moving right along, because nobody wants to hear about Lamar's underwear sponsorship. What we're going to do today is very similar to what we're normally doing, but we're going to talk about through the basics of the film. We're going to give a quick, very, very quick spoiler-free rating, and then we're going to dig in because this movie's been out for a hot minute. Mm-hmm. So we just want to get into the nuts and bolts of it because it's a juicy one. It's a fun one. So Molly's Game, written and directed by Mr. Aaron Sorkin. In 2017, his directorial debut, if you didn't already know, which I think is really cool. Kind of surprising that it's his first, even with all the other stuff that he's written, as we probably know, he's a very proficient writer. He's done a ton of things, including but not limited to like The West Wing, Steve Jobs, which is one of my favorite written films as well. It's very beautifully done. Social Network. And you can just tell when you see and hear his material. It's very clear that I think it's Aaron Sorkin without you sometimes even needing to be told.
Yeah, I picked up on that. I mean, I knew it was a Sorkin. I was actually shocked with how often I've heard his name mentioned, that this was his directorial debut. I thought he had directed a bunch of stuff before this, but apparently not. But yeah, I picked up on that. And we'll get into that when we get to the spoilers of sort of the way that his characters speak and the parts that I think do work and the parts that I think don't work. So there's a little teaser for you.
I have a feeling that Lamar's going to talk shit about Aaron Sorkin, and I don't think it's going to go well. I'm just warning you.
You're going to have a bad time.
Yeah, going to have a bad time. Okay, well, before we get into the bad time, we'll get into some major cast and crew, some fun stuff. So Jessica Chastain taking the lead with Molly, who is a bad bitch, both as this character and as an actress. In case you didn't know, on the pod, are big fans of Miss Jessica Chastain. So she's done one gabazillion things, basically, and has been mentioned on the pod a handful of times. So if you haven't seen her in anything, I don't know what you're doing. You're living under a rock. What are you guys' favorite Jessica Chastains while we're here?
Ooh, I'll chime in. I think it's a toss-up. I really loved her in Molly's Game, of course. Sloane, I think, is a good top runner for me on that. Miss Sloane on that one. I love seeing her play that power lobbyist. I think it's just a good look for her. And holy dynamite, yeah. Did she look amazing in this movie.
Yeah, yeah. That is a deep cut, by the way. I respect the shit out of that selection. Not a lot of people have seen Miss Sloane. It wasn't actually that well reviewed. I think it's because of the ending. Slight spoiler, just not everybody's favorite. And I loved it, actually. I thought it was great. But yeah, not one that's a common choice, I don't think. Lamar, what about you?
I'm going to do the opposite of what Kelsey did. I'm not going to pick a deep cut. I'm going to say I'm that idiot who still confuses her, Bryce Dallas Howard, Amy Adams on occasion. I have such a hard time when Janelle and I play this game, which I'm going to give some free advertising here, called Movie Grid. And I think it's moviegrid.io. It's
kind Again, of like we're going to get a sponsor, guys, eventually. Someday.
We're trying so hard.
We're doing it, I think.
We're dedicating so much time every week to trying to get sponsors as opposed to actually talking about movies. But you can play it. It's free. It's kind of like a daily, like a Wordle type game. But they give you sort of 9 boxes. And the rows are actors or actresses. And the columns are sort of categories of could be the years the movies came out. It could be directed by so-and-so. It could be the genre. And you have to pick movies. And you're not allowed to repeat. So you're basically picking 9. Anytime it's Jessica Chastain, Bryce Dallas, I will fuck up at least once by being like, oh, she was in the Jurassic World movie, right? No, or like, she was in The Help. Well, this one was, but that one wasn't. It is, yeah, it's rough. I'm sorry, Jessica.
It hurts. Okay, but you still didn't tell us your, like, do you have a favorite that you can think of that reminds you of her? Do you want me to list them off and remind you of
I'm just going to say Molly's Game. It's the best one.
The best one.
I know she's in it. Yeah. I will say though, it's one of my favorite icebreakers is asking folks if you could pick who would play you in a movie, who would you go with? So maybe we do that as a cold open one of these weeks. But the fun fact coming out of this is that Molly Bloom actually wanted Jessica Chastain to be the one cast to play her. And it ended up happening. So how often do you actually get to be like, I want them to play me?
Wow. And it's actually a really good fit. I didn't know that she wanted her, but that, I mean, it kind of makes sense. She is a really good fit for it. It's hard for me to pick a favorite Jessica Chastain because I love pretty much everything that she does. I personally, you know, she debuted kind of like broke to fame with The Help, but I had actually seen her super deep cut in like her old TV guest appearances. Like we're talking Veronica Mars days. Like I saw Jessica Chastain. So I've been a big fan for a long time, but as you know, Lamar, one of my favorites that we've talked about on the pod before is Crimson Peak. And I think that that is just such a cool role that she does because it's so different from some, I mean, she is quite the range. She's done a lot of things, but I just think it's one of the few times we see her be like a full blown, you know, villain. And that's kind of fun. So I like it. Cool, cool. Yeah. All righty. Well, let's dig into the rest of these folks. I promise to not fangirl over Jessica Chastain the whole time, but I will like literally drool over this next one. Idris Elba. Oh my God. He is a gorgeous, gorgeous man. And he plays her lawyer in this.
Can I squeal? Would that be awkward?
You can totally squeal because he is squeal worthy. Like, Well, and a lot of people, I don't know what everyone knows him from. Like, what do you guys know him from? He's probably, I mean, he's been in a million things as well.
I knew him from The Wire. That was where I first fell in love. And so, yeah, Stricker Bell. I mean, come on. I'm in. Anything he's in. I like to play the worst role game of like, what role were they the worst in? And like, Idris Elba is kind of hard because like some of the answers, you're like, he was great in that. I loved him. I thought he was terrific. So, yeah, I think he's dynamite in the movie.
Yeah. I even remember seeing a trailer for that, what was it, Beast that came out last year with him fighting a lion or something. It didn't look like a great trailer, but then I heard the reviews were pretty good. So it's like hard for him to, he doesn't give a bad performance. I'll give him that.
Exactly.
He super doesn't. I liked him and he's done a lot of animated stuff, which I think people forget. He's done a lot of fun animated stuff. Like he was in Zootopia that you just saw, Lamar.
Just watched
he's like
that a couple weeks ago.
And he's Heimdall in Marvel Cinematic Universe, which he's a great Heimdall. So yeah, he's awesome. Another one of those who just does a bunch of great stuff. But another one, Kevin Costner. This is another drool-worthy for me. This was my very first crush, was Mr. Kevin Costner. You're welcome.
Which movie did you know that.
Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, obsessed. I was in love with him. Love with him. But he's, of course, as we know, done a bazillion other things. So yeah, in case you guys couldn't tell, like, I'm in love with our leads here. I'm in love with all three of our leads. This is half of why I love this movie. So they're great. We also have a few others. Our major antagonist here for a big chunk of this is Michael Cera's character, who Lamar alluded to earlier is Player X. And then we have Jeremy Strong, who plays her evil asshole boss. We have a couple other appearances, Chris O'Dowd, Bill Camp, a few others. But that's kind of the core cast of characters. Did you have any others, guys, that you wanted to shout out?
No, I think there's some really good, I almost use the word bit players, and that feels so mean. I guess character actors and whatnot. I did like, this is a throwback that Kelsey might appreciate, that her original lawyer, I guess in the old trial, without spoiling anything, he was a lawyer on The Wire as well. He was actually Barksdale's lawyer. So him and Idris Elba had some partnership there way back in the day.
That's a good callback. He also is a lawyer in the TV series Billions. And so he must just be typecast lawyer.
I said that to Janelle. I was like, this guy just always plays lawyers and he looks like a lawyer and he sounds like one. So what, yep. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Exactly. I totally forgot about him in Billions. That's totally true. That's awesome. Yeah, definitely yeah. Typecasted a little bit. But hey, he does it. Yeah, like you said, Lamar, it ain't broke, don't fix it. He does a good job. Well, let's give a quick summary. Nothing crazy. We're not going to give spoilers again here at the top. But quick summary is that this is essentially, it's based on a true story. It's about Molly Bloom. And she is nicknamed the Poker Princess. But she was an Olympic class skier who ran the world's most exclusive high stakes poker game and became an FBI target, which is what this story is all about. Her becoming a target, her fighting those charges. But also, like, how does she get there? Like, this clearly super sharp, intelligent woman. How did she end up in this situation is really what this film is about. So,
and now, I think, is this film based directly on the book she wrote, or what, did she sit down and actually contribute or change any of this? Do we know how it all came about?
She didn't write it, but she's given credit as part of the writing team as source material. So the source material is her book. And then I think if I recall correctly, she's an executive producer, or she's, you know, whatever, a producer, guest producer on this film. So I think she contributed more context, but Aaron Sorkin is known for his research, and I'm sure a lot of this is source material plus Aaron Sorkin's own work and kind of putting those pieces together.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, let's do a quick round robin of reviews before we get into the nitty gritty and the spoilers of it all. What does everyone think about this movie? What is your rating? Lamar, we'll start with you, because apparently you're going to talk shit. Go.
I'm not going to talk that much shit. I think we'll get into the things that irked me a little bit a little later on. I think that if you enjoy Aaron Sorkin's writing, if you enjoy movies with... The interesting thing is it's based on a true story. And when you have that, you're getting the... Especially in the case of an autobiography, you're literally just getting that person's perspective. Of course, they're the hero of their story. It feels like they never do anything wrong. So that... always makes me feel a little weird watching stuff. Like, it would be like if Mark Zuckerberg had written The Social Network, like had told the story and was like, here's what happened. But even in that, I feel like he gets made more of a villain than Molly ever gets made in this. Who's to say that she wasn't flawless in her personal life and like was this perfect saint? But that irked me just a little bit. And there are a couple other things, but I think that overall, if you enjoy Sorkin's writing and characters like that, or movies like Wolf of Wall Street, where you're getting the perspective of this character with questionable morals, but you're getting the narration and you enjoy that sort of drama, or you like poker, because I think this might actually be the best poker movie I've ever seen, honestly, the way that it expresses it. And it's obviously much bigger than just a poker game. It's her life. So I think at the end of the day, I would give it like a 7, 7.5. I thought it was enjoyable. I do think it's very watchable, but I think there are going to be some people put off a little bit by the dialogue, the writing, and things like that. But I think it's a really interesting story.
That's better than I thought you were going to do.
Oh, no, I'm not going to hammer it. I just, yeah.
Okay, you just have some feelings. All right, fair enough.
I got some feelings.
Kelsey, how about you?
Oh, goodness. Good review. I think you said a lot of things spot on there, especially agree with the bias of like, hey, how much was it influenced by, you know, Molly Bloom kind of creating this narrative that Sorkin gets to kind of funnel through his own experience and to get to say like, hey, what's this movie really about, right? Because, you know, the question is rate this movie, but my other question is how many movies are we actually watching here? Like, what plot am I actually rating? Because there is classic Sorkin so much involved here. And so, yeah, if you want to rate the poker game part of the movie, you might give it a 9 out of 10. If you want to rate the father-daughter relationship part of the movie, you might give that a 3 out of 10. And so you gotta figure out what your average is out to here. So for me, my average, I gotta beat Lamar here just a smidge, because I want to give him some fighting ground for later on in the pod, but I'll give it an 8 out of 10.
Okay. Ooh, throwing down. I love it. Well, you guys should know that you're pretty in line with the general ratings on this film. The IMDb was 7.4 out of 10, and the Rotten Tomatoes was 81% critics, 84% audience. And I would say I'm pretty in line with the 8. Like, I'd give it a solid 8, and I agree. I think it's the writing probably will throw other people off, especially if you're not an Aaron Sorkin fan, Lamar. So I get that. But I love Aaron Sorkin, so I was kind of here for it. But we can dig into it a little bit more, because I think it's interesting that you guys think that there's such a bias toward her. I think she's calling herself out pretty hard for some stupid shit she did. But I do think it makes her look overall very smart, but somebody who made a lot of mistakes, clearly. So that's interesting. Interesting takes. Let's get in. Let's dig into it. As you have heard on the pod before, turn around, don't drown. It's spoiler time. All right. So it does. It kicks off with a bang. We meet her as an Olympic class skier, which we, again, to your point earlier, Lamar, she's like, she's great at everything. She's super competitive. Turns out that she's, you know, top three in the world for women's moguls, which I like followed skiing in the Winter Olympics once every 4 years or whatever. But like, did anybody know there was a very specific mogul category? I didn't. I was like, until I heard about Molly Bloom, I was like, I didn't know this was the thing that you could just be good at moguls. But apparently,
I still don't think
saying.
I know what a mogul is in regards to the Olympics. I know it's like a businessman here in the States. I don't know what they do in Europe, but
it's yeah, the like bumps. It's the like it, course.
I've always thought those were just, you know, non-magic people. But yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Muggles, moguls, same different.
I'll play my Texas card right now. It's Kelsey from Texas.
That's so true. Like us, I mean, I would maybe expect Lamar, but still, you know, it's a little bit different. But yeah, here in Texas, we don't get snow. I can count on one hand the number of times I've had snow in my life. So yeah, I don't speak.
Maybe if I was born here, I wouldn't even know what skiing was. So I mean, I don't think it's so bad to not know what a mogul is.
No, okay. I'm glad everybody's on the same page, because it was new information for me, for sure. But apparently she's a badass at it, is the point, mm-hmm. until this horrible, horrible accident happens to her. And she can't be an Olympic skier anymore, after all.
And I was thrown by that, because in the first 5 minutes, you get this sort of, you already get hit with the Aaron Sorkin narration of like, I'm going to talk you through this thing, and it's going to be kind of witty and kind of mean and kind of all these different things and a little too clever, but that's writing, right? But then you get her doing this, you know, downhill skiing. She loses a ski, does a backflip, lands on her head. And hadn't seen the trailer, so I thought this was going to be like a slapstick comedy, like an Adam Sandler joint or like a Dumb and Dumber. And that's not what the movie is at all. So I got really excited. Maybe that's why my rating isn't an 8. But
I was going to say... You set yourself up for failure there if that's what you thought was going to happen.
Was it all downhill from there for you, Lamar? Is that the word?
Oh,
you're going to out dad joke. You're an actual dad, so I'm definitely getting out dad joked today.
Oh, you got to relinquish your crown for 1 week, Lamar. Jeez, come on. Oh, that is hilarious. It was a big moment for her and literally changed her trajectory. She ends up wandering in LA and stumbles upon this shitty assistant job with what is it, Dean Keith or whatever. They gave him some terrible like two first names name, yeah, basically. Yeah. Yeah. And he's a real jerk, played excellently by Jeremy Strong.
Kelsey and I talked about this off the air yesterday.
What about him? Anything good? Anything terrible?
Well, is he like number one draft pick for like can't play jerk in movie or show? Like you can't pick anybody else. Like if you need the Jeremy Strong, bring him in for that role. Like, oh man, so great. I forgot he was in this, and then sure as he popped up, I was like, dang, Outside the Hat, this is the guy I know. I don't know what was up with the hat he was wearing in the movie. I thought it was pretty
I
great.
Know. But, that was a weird choice for him.
He nailed it. But now knowing that he's so methodical with his process and like him doing the poker chips down the finger, like all that waterfall stuff, like you could tell, like, mm-hmm. yeah, I respected this rewatch to see that like he probably put so much into being exactly who he was.
You're right. He does get picked for the asshole roles very often, or just at least like not totally likable. I mean, sidebar, he was Succession. Did y'all watch Succession?
Yeah, Kendall Roy. This is like shades of that for sure.
There's some shades of it for sure. You can see it. But you like, again, you learn a lot about his process as an actor. And I learned more about it actually with Succession before this. And
right.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me how he deep dived into this role. And he comes out, yeah, a very legitimate asshole. He does a great job. But yeah, he's kind of hardcore. He's kind of wild as an actor when it comes to these things. Very, very intense.
Yeah.
I think he's like known for being sort of a method actor. So I assume before every role, he's just berating Starbucks employees. That's how he practices, just vaguely insulting. He doesn't feel like he never plays a true sociopath. He just feels socially awkward and kind of disconnected of just like, does not give a shit about anybody's emotions in all these different roles that he plays, it seems.
Yeah.
He plays a
feral.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good word for it.
Yes. Yes. And he's a narcissist, like an utter narcissist in every single thing that you see him in. And that really comes through here. So I think like I would love to spend time getting into the nitty gritty of her whole, I don't know, downfall-esque. But short story is she gets essentially, you know, she doesn't get to do this Olympic thing. She falls into this job with him and she keeps putting off college where she's, or I should say law school specifically, where she scored a 173 on her LSAT. Have either of you taken the LSAT?
Hundreds of times. I've never passed.
I took the practice LSAT, maybe.
I can tell you a 173 is quite hard. I have taken the LSAT and I got a 164. So this is really hard to do. It's a big jump from a 164 to a 173. Like she's super, super smart. And I think that's why they share her score on this is like she's really good. And she just keeps putting it off. She's making money and she keeps putting it off. And it's like, why don't you want to go to law school? Like, you're so smart. You'd rather play poker. How do we feel about her distraction with poker to begin with? It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, they make it painfully obvious that she's real book smart. Like, it was like,
they tell you.
Like, she is a winner at everything. And so it was a little perplexing to see what she's navigating towards now that she's lost the dream of becoming the Olympian. But it's like, you kind of had a second, you know, ace in the hole here with this 173, the law school path feels like that can't be that hard to get back into. But
yeah, I think it's crazy. But I also wonder, like, did her brain just need a break? Was she just like, my brain hurts. I'm super done working so hard at everything and I need a breather. And then that breather just went on a little long. I don't know. I wonder if that's, she just needed, because she had been like clearly driven to perfection by her dad for however many years. So I just wonder if she was like, you know what? I need a break from all this.
That's how I read it initially, was it was sort of like the eccentricities of the rich or like the privilege where it's like, oh, I could just go do whatever the hell I want and explore this other career or opportunity because I can always come back to this. And I read it that way. But that's what bothered me. She never tells you that. To me, it seemed clear. Yeah, because her dad forced her to do all this other stuff and it didn't work out. Obviously, she's rebelling, but her narration never tells it. She never admits to that. And that was one of the things where she just makes it seem like this just happened to me. And I took this opportunity and then I got paid this money and I like money. But I'm just like, I wish she would own it a little more if that's the case of what happened, because otherwise I don't get why it happens, to be honest.
Well, it has one of my favorite like movie trope like segue scenes, which is like brings you to the city. And it's like, and then I went to LA. Mm-hmm. And it's just when they introduce the city as part of this new character in the film, that happens after her skiing incident. Too, I think Mackenzie's point that now makes more sense in my head is like she needed a break. And right, the break was entering into Los Angeles the way they so smoothly made that transition.
Yeah, I think that's a good call out. Like she gets influenced by her surroundings for sure. And I mean, and LA is nothing if not influential for better or for worse, right? So she's in this radically different environment than a training schedule and in Colorado and all of that. And she just kind of leans in. And to your point earlier, Lamar, like she has to be the best at everything. So she's going to be the best at being LA. She just leans into that really hard. And I mean, you even see her in the bar being a cocktail waitress for Jesus. She's just like, I'm a upsell. So again, she's just got to be the best at everything. But yeah, it's kind of disappointing, I think, honestly, because she is so smart. She is such a clearly so book smart. And also not just smart. I think the thing about lawyers and law school in particular, and one of the reasons I considered it, is like it is so much about your ability to make an argument and to speak eloquently and defend a point and win a point over. And she is shown over and over and over to be really good at that. So I think that was something that was hard to watch, where you're like, you missed your calling and now you're under federal indictment. Like, it feels like a bad call.
Well, and I think that's too where like Idris Elba's character really latches on to that. He reads her emotional intelligence and really is like, okay, your emotional intelligence plus your book smart intelligence, all of this doesn't seem traditional or typical. And so, yeah, he really latches on to her. And then you even see it in the meeting or the deposition, or I forget exactly what it is, like off the record deposition meeting where they are just owning those other lawyers. Like, it is embarrassing. They, like, are laughing at them in a way that's kind of their game, recognizing the other game and being part of that kind of, like, okay, I see what's up.
And I love that he's so brilliant as well. I mean, we talk a lot about Molly, obviously, being intelligent on this movie. But once they meet, he's reading her really well. He's also reading the scene very well. He's understanding, like, the lay of the land, even though it's made clear that he doesn't particularly represent these kinds of criminals or violent criminals or mobsters or things, but he's like, he's not an idiot, right? He can read the room and he can read her as well. And I like that they're sort of foils of each other in that he feels like something she could have done and been had she not made some of these choices, but they have this mutual respect, I think.
That's a good call out, Mackenzie. I didn't pick up on that. That he's like on the career, and obviously it's my first time through the movie, but he's on the career track that she could have been in. I like that call out a lot. I found myself wavering back and forth on their sort of dynamic because there were times they both give great individual performances. And there are times when there's specific scenes, you know, when he gives that speech in the deposition, he takes her and is trying to like, he's defending her even though he's not in front of a judge right now, why are we punishing her for all of these things when she could have taken the easy way out? And he says it much more eloquently than I'm saying it, but that speech sealed the higher rating for me because I thought that was my favorite scene. There's scenes where they interact and engage with each other that are very touching, but there are other scenes where it might be the dialogue. It's not the actor's fault, but it's almost like too clever where they're being too quippy and it takes on that Gilmore Girls quality that, you know, I know Aaron Sorkin didn't write Gilmore Girls, but he might as well have because that's what this
Amy Sherman Palladino, Daniel Palladino. Anyway, continue.
So there were scenes like that where I was like, this doesn't feel not real, but it's the dynamic was a little different. And then I was reading up and it didn't shock me to hear they actually only had 10 days to shoot together on this film, Idris Elba and Jessica Chastain. Mm. They had 10 days and they had to get through like 60 pages of dialogue together. So that I think is where some of that disconnect comes from of their chemistry in some scenes compared to others. But obviously there's somewhere they just nail it.
Yeah, I think they have a ton of material to get through. And that is very typical of Aaron Sorkin and actually also Amy Sherman-Palladino, very similar vibes where like their scripts are way longer for the amount of time that they're in. And you can tell they're eking out every single word, but I like that. Like I loved Gilmore Girls and I love most things that like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is another thing that is very similar and it's written by Amy Sherman-Palladino. West Wing is like that. Social Network is like that. It's very witty and quippy and responsive. And I love that ability to have a quick retort and engage in this conversation that it does feel to some degree, I hear what you're saying. It feels written, but it also, if you like the subject matter and you find this interesting, feels plausible, at least to me. I'm like, I'm following all of this. This feels like something that you could say that somebody would say. But I hear you where at some points it feels like, okay, this is not how people talk. You know, this is just not how normal people talk. But I also think that there are those speeches like Idris Elba's, like you said, that are just so fucking fire that you have so much respect for what was just said that you can't ignore it. You know, I think of every single Aaron Sorkin thing I've ever watched, and there is at least one of those speeches, right? Oh, there's a West Wing moment for that. There's the American President moment for that. There's a Steve Jobs moment for that. You know what I mean? Like everything that he writes has at least one of those really powerful speeches.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's what I was going to chime in and say. I was, you know, kind of late to West Wing, but man, I watched it straight through. I thought it was fantastic. And so seeing so much of that, I think has perhaps maybe nubbed me to seeing it then just happen and been like Sorkinized. I like understand and speak his language like a little bit.
Yeah.
And so seeing it in that category, it's like, yeah, this is just like a new character coming into West Wing and just reading the Sorkin dialogue the way an actor needs to read it. So seeing them engage, I think definitely felt that, but I 100% agree, Lamar. Like, it almost seemed like they were just playing characters that were in the same room together, but playing that Sorkin character.
Yeah. And I think I can suspend some disbelief on this, regardless of it being a true story, but because they're both lawyers. So it would make sense that they would be very quick on their feet and quick to respond. But there was a specific scene. I don't remember what the context was. It was one of the first times they interacted in his office. And it just seemed like Elba was at like a 9 or a 10 emotionally, and Chastain was at like a 6. And it just, the two settings they were at made the scene feel a little strange to me. But like I said, it was one out of a bunch of scenes that they had together, but there were just some inconsistencies.
Yeah, I can't think of those scenes, but I could see how you could have that, because I feel like they are in different spaces emotionally throughout the movie. Like, he's learning about her and she's already kind of resigned herself at this point to not only these charges, but just like how she got here to some degree. And you're almost like going through that retrospective with her. And it feels like he's learning all of that during this process of representing her in this case. And so I could see how they would be maybe at different levels for part of it. But we have to talk about a few things. I know we got a lot to get to, but one of the things I want to talk about is how she got here is her dad. You know, she clearly has a really challenging relationship with her father, who was a perfectionist, who drove her to be this, you know, got to be the best at everything. And you see that throughout snippets, right? Like, you see that she's really young and she's, you know, skiing way too hard and literally hurting herself to be the best at this thing. And, you know, when she's older and she's, you know, arguing with him about Freud at the kitchen table and all these things you learn about that relationship. And I'm curious what you guys think about that dynamic and how it plays out.
Man, he really throws it in her face. Like, she literally breaks her back for this. Literally goes through this description of like how her spine broke in so many places and required X amount of surgery, but don't worry, I got back on the skis and became Olympic bound, right? Puts it right in front of your face. So yeah, definitely writes the dad to be quite the sergeant of perfection, right? And then, you know, you're later introduced to the brothers of it all and their success and stuff like that. And it gets played throughout the rest of the movie, the impact of him being such a driver towards perfection and how that kind of precipitates into the cascading events that get her, you know, charged up on a RICO case.
Yeah. Not many people can say my dad drove me to such perfectionism that I am under federal indictment and now guilty of a felony.
Well, I hope we'll get to the conversation on the park bench. I'm sure we will. But yeah, like it gets
intense.
Yeah, well, we can jump around, so we can get to that very quickly. I liked the narrative structure was a little strange to me, because we start in the past, then we jump into the present, then we go back a little, not as far in the past, and then we're getting childhood snippets. It was a lot of jumping around, and eventually I found my footing of like, oh, this is the one timeline, this is what they're referencing back to, this is shots from when she was a kid, like all that stuff. So I liked the narrative structure and how we see the interactions and how her father and her family has sort of shaped her life. Gave me big time sort of like Whiplash vibes,
yeah,
of, you know, this instructor just pushing for greatness, regardless of how hard they're being on their pupil. But yeah, to Kelsey's point, that last, when he showed up in New York, the entire circumstance of that, and as I said, if it's a true story and this is how it actually happened, more power to him. It just felt odd, and the way it was sort of shot, I thought she was having a vision. That he was like, hey, she's skating, and he taps her, says, bend your knees, and she falls. And I was like, oh, she's having a vision of her dad, and it's fucking with her. No, he's actually there. And then they go sit on the bench, and there's this weird scene where he's playing therapist, which kind of ties into when he would ask her the questions on camera when she was a kid, which is equally weird, interviewing her of like, what do you think about love? What do you think about family? And it's like, dad, I'm fucking 8 years old. Leave me alone. I just want to eat s'mores. But that scene on the bench, Kelsey, you can expand on it. It didn't land for me, at least the first like half of it, because again, because the writing is what it is, I didn't buy. You can tell she's very standoffish, but it's like she shouldn't be giving him the time of day because of their relationship. But, you know, she's doing it, I guess, out of respect or whatever. They have this weird conversation and he's doing this therapy thing that, again, just did not hit home for me of him saying, you have to ask this question. She knows what to ask, and he gives her this.
Isn't that great? Yeah. She just knew what to ask.
What a relationship.
I felt like such a dummy. I was like, I have no idea what I would ask. And she like she says it, and I was like, man, I wouldn't have gotten there.
Yeah, I totally, like, I just, it didn't hit, I will say, when he gets emotional over the assault, which we haven't talked about yet, and I'm sure we'll get into that and how difficult that was to watch, but when he gets emotional over that is when I was like, this feels real, which I guess is the point, is going from this arm's length father-daughter relationship to, no, I do really care about you. But it just, something about it felt a little off.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, Kelsey, you chime in here, but it felt like such a an Aaron Sorkin-y scene. So I kind of was like, this is on brand. I don't know. I just sort of, I guess in some ways I expected a conversation like that. I agree that the circumstances and how he found her are wildly unrealistic. And I don't think that's how that happened, by the way. I do think I heard an interview to that effect. But anyway, I did think that was, I don't know, I thought it was a moment of catharsis for them, which was great. But I do think it was a bit manufactured. I guess I could say that. I think it was kind of a manufactured moment in the film specifically.
It was so nice. It just like, oh, isn't this nice? Like, can I just pop up in the middle of Central Park at an ice skating rink? And first of all, can I nitpick one quick thing? I had it in one of my notes. Ice skating, why? Like, why do people try to do ice skating in movies? Like, it never works for me. You always have to zoom out, and this person like dodging and weaving through people. Like, it's just, I don't think ice skating, I don't think we've quite nailed it yet. And so I don't know why we keep doing that. But yeah, he shows up. It's so nice, right? And like, this has to be the scene that got Costner in, right? I kept asking myself, why is he playing this role? Like, what's in this for him? Like, at this stage, right? Why is it had to just be like, hey, I got this great scene for you, Aaron talking to Costner, like, sells him on the scene, gets him in, because he pops up out of nowhere, and then all of a sudden, like, bing, bang, boom, they're having a good time, having dinner together, just like cheersing. And it's just like, what just happened in 10 minutes of the, you know, two and a half hour movie? It's like, I'm so lost right now. But yeah, it's definitely Sorkin writing to a T of all these other six scenes. I'm just gonna like weave them all together, and it's gonna mm-hmm. look great. But yeah, it was so,
it's tied up with a Sorkin bow.
Same thing, Lamar. I was like, oh wait, is this like a, do I need to go back in time? And did she hit her head and she's been in like a coma this whole time? And like, like, this is all now.
This is all fake.
Yeah. It's all a dream. For a half second. And I was like, oh my goodness gracious.
Like, I dreamt I was in the Olympics. And it's like, Katie, you're a middle school teacher.
Oh.
What a twist.
I thought it was cute though. I did. I will say my overarching takeaway of that scene is I like it. And I think it probably is the emotional moment between her and her dad and her Kevin Costner's character. And like that moment in particular, I think maybe that hits super home for me because it reminds you of my dad talking about my accident at one point. And we had a very similar conversation, not because of anything that he did, obviously, but my accident profoundly impacted my dad and my family and all of that. And so he was very emotional about that at one point. And it like, he almost looks like my dad in that scene. It was really wild. So it just, it takes me into that and feels really, again, cathartic. Like, that's why I think my takeaway there is that it's a very cathartic moment.
I just hope that if she ever writes a sequel to the book, that we find out that her dad did have that guy killed and tortured because they had
fucking because you know what, that is the coolest dad moment. And I know that that sounds so extreme, but it's like, wouldn't you as a dad, of course, listen, we got a dad on the pod, wouldn't you be like, if this happened to my daughter, like, I will go to any lengths to find this person and be rid of them. Because I mean, it was brutal what happens to her assault, we can get into that, but it was brutal.
Definitely. I know the first time I watched this wasn't father to a daughter. Now on the rewatch, being father to daughter was like, I get that. Like, I can feel
I'm capable
that.
Of some light murder.
I'm cool with. Now the other stuff, like, ooh, the hat on a hat of like, he was a real tough driving dad. It's like, oh yeah. Also, like, he cheated on her mom, and she's kind of rightfully a little bit upset about that and takes him to task. And he's like, so I wasn't perfect, but look at all my successes. Like, my kids are so great.
Look what I gave you.
I made you guys awesome. And that's the other thing. He's giving himself credit for that, right? Like, and of course, your parents take a role, right? But like, these kids could have done a number of things and they could have switched gears or whatever. But he's like, pretty much taking sole credit for what badasses his children are. So yeah, that's kind of gross.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you this question, Mackenzie. So obviously, no, English is a passion of yours. And there was a specific scene that I just want to get your take on.
Costner, I have a feeling I know what you're going to say, but continue.
She's like 8 years old, and like he's like, they've been out there since six, and his wife, who I have a little bit of a nitpick, like, you have Kevin Costner here. I have no idea who the wife was in this movie. I was like, they couldn't have found anybody maybe a little bit more like rank appropriate to like his fame, like
to just, a Kevin Costner, exactly. Like, we couldn't find anybody close. This is just some no name woman. Sorry, we didn't even call her up.
A Danny DeVito, maybe. You know.
But anyway, she says she's tired, and he says, "What's another word for tired?
What's a synonym for tired?" And we can go home. Yeah.
And her response is weak, and I was like, "I don't think that's tired."
That is incorrect. It is actually not synonymous with tired. I am, yes, English nerd on the pod checking in. It is not, in fact, a synonym, and I was also annoyed. I was like, "He said name is synonym."
No, I was reading that as he had trained her to think that when you're tired, really you're showing weak. That's how I read it.
Oh, 100%.
He's drilled her, and 100%. Then that's why she's like, oh no, let's stay. Let's keep practicing. I want to break my back.
Oh,
again.
For sure. You that's know? Like the it, that's the intent, but it's just not a synonym for tired.
I see.
We're just nitpicking the Englishy of it all, because I know what they were trying to make happen, but it's not a synonym for tired, in case you were curious.
Oh yeah. Immediately thought Mackenzie probably isn't going to appreciate that. He said, what's another word for tired? And she said weak. Come on.
I thought you
weary,
were getting at,
fatigued, exhausted. Yeah.
I thought you were getting at the poem that Chris O'Dowd's character reads later, and he just completely fucks it up. And he's like, "Do you like poetry?" Thought that's where you were going with that.
Oh God, I forgot about his poem. Actually,
those interactions, I think that was aside from any part that Idris Elba has in this film. I thought my favorite interactions were Molly and Douglas. I thought it was interesting because you said earlier, you know, we have our villain for like the first third of the movie, right?
Right.
But then things change, and throughout the film, not only do the villains or the bad guys in the scenario sort of change, but the people she's interacting with change. And there's not a lot that carries over from these different timelines of her life. But I thought that little time that we get to spend with Chris O'Dowd there, just being this like pathetic, he's not being creepy. He's just a
but
drunk.
He is
and he's
a little,
trying to,
he's a little pathetic. To, yeah.
Pathetic
and she's just
for it. Yeah.
She's just letting him hover. Like, that is what's just so funny. She's literally sitting there doing the books and like trying to do anything but talk to this guy, but she just patronizes him and lets him do it. And then you even see her a couple of times participating in these conversations with him, and you're just kind of like, why are you letting this happen? Kick this fucker out. He's not playing right now. What is the point of this? And they have some interesting interactions, that's for sure. One of the most painful ones we got to hit on, that we have a couple. We got to talk about Player X in a second for number of reasons, but one of the things that hits me so hard in this movie is the Harlan storyline. And on rewatch, I sort of forget what kind of a small part of the movie it actually is, because for me it's like a big takeaway, and rewatching it I was like, oh, this is a few minutes, really. This occurs in the course of, you know, one evening overall. She's spotted him at this other place that he plays, but really couple nights, it seems like he's playing straight through, but one long scene. And I just thought that was so sad. I don't have any specific thing about the film that it does for the film, but it's more like, this story is so heart-wrenching. This guy who is like, has his shit together, and he plays poker so well and so tight, mm-hmm. and this idiot Brad is the thing that sends him off the rails. And like, that was just, that was so frustrating for me, and such a story in a not poetic way that turns out to be so painful. He loses his livelihood, he loses his wife, and you just see that fall apart. And I thought that was just so hard to watch. So hard to watch.
I think I almost said the wrong thing right off the bat. I don't want to lead with that. I do think the story of his is very sad, but I wanted to point out that Harlan, that's part of why I said earlier, I think this might be my favorite poker movie, because I feel like this does the best job
of explaining poker,
explaining the sport and how there's different types of players, mm-hmm. you know, because I've been at tables with folks who are just gambling, like they're just mm-hmm. in it for the thrill. They don't really give a shit. It's just money. They're throwing it away. Mm-hmm. And then you go to tables with people like Harlan, who are basically play professionals, poker, for lack says. Of a better yeah. word. Yeah. Of I'm trying to, you know, pay my way and make a living off of this. Mm-hmm. So I was actually very impressed because the movie made me think they had done something wrong because they said, oh, nobody liked him because like he doesn't give a lot of action. And I was like, wait, but that's how you're supposed to do. You're supposed to only play the hands right. where you have a percentage of win. And then they called it out and corrected right. it. And I'm like, oh, they were doing that on purpose. So yeah. I really enjoyed the movie for that.
Yeah, he's playing the game the way you're supposed to, a combination of there are odds that you can do nothing about, but you can be strategic about it. Right. Mm-hmm. About when you engage with those odds and when you don't. And he is the best player that you see that they go into the deep dive on it. It's implied, of course, that player X is a great player, but he also clearly finagles the odds. Yeah. We can get into that. But he's like straight out of the box, one of the best, most strategic players as Harlan. And also it's just heartbreaking. Obviously, he loves his wife and in one night, in one scene can literally ruin his life. And it's just such a hard one to watch. And then bringing player X into the scene, you find out that he's had something to do with this the whole time. Harlan's been playing on his dime and that's what causes this whole game to fall apart. And it turns out that, you know, player X outs her and all of that. But I'm sure you both know this, but do y'all know who player X is based off of?
Toby Maguire,
folks. Yeah.
Spider-Man.
Spider-Man. And
Spider-Man 2.
Whatever iteration of Spider-Man, that one, one of them. But man, they make him a douche in this. Like he yeah. is a super douche. And if he is anything close to, even if he's a shadow of this guy, Tobey Maguire kind of sucks, which I think is funny that that's kind of public knowledge now because yeah. he's quite terrible in this film. And he goes the same way as Jeremy Strong's character, where they're both like kind of obsessed with her and pissed that she's not obsessed with them. Yeah. And ultimately, I think you guys tell me, I think that's why they fall apart, why it falls apart, because she doesn't give them the attention that they want. She just doesn't care about them.
Sure. She's not participating in the game they're playing, right? So they have to bring her into right. their world where it's like, we win, you lose, right? And so I actually wrote that down when you guys were talking at the top and you were about the everybody gets a trophy. And I was like, oh, I should ask McKenzie, is it more important for you to win or for them to lose, right? Because like that's the struggle throughout mm-hmm. the movie is like, well,
yeah,
which is it here, right? And so to Lamar's point, they do a great job, I think, of explaining and showing the different sides of poker where it's far more involved than just like cards on a table and chips that you put in mm-hmm. and bluffing and raising and all of that, all of the mechanics of poker. They don't really spend too much time on that in the movie. They spend more time investing in like the psyches of the people who play poker, right? Mm-hmm. How it can turn and how discipline can turn to failure very quickly. That's going on tilt, right? And that's that Harlan's mm-hmm. character mm-hmm. is such an allegory for the movie itself where it's like, and that's what happened. That's what happened to Molly when she took the rake and she just calls it out. And they make such a good focus on like, and that's when I broke the law. Right. And that was her own yeah. kind of like now like axe to carry throughout the rest of the movie and how you kind of get involved with her coming to terms with that. She did break the law, that she wasn't. She mm-hmm. was still wasn't perfect, even though she thought she could be, right? So like, yeah, it's a pretty powerful scene. And I thought it was cool the way they used something complex like a poker game to like a poker arc or a poker, you know, mm-hmm. real collapse to show it.
Now, do you think that McKenzie, first, should we have an announcement on here of like, if you are addicted to gambling and you can't stop, call this number? Because if we put that on here, will they sponsor us? I think that's a nonprofit, but maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. I feel, again, we have a number of examples. We're just going to send out sponsorship requests at the end of this app. We're doing great today. We have so many options.
I wrote that down. Is this movie a sports movie? What is this movie? Feels like a cautionary tale about addiction.
It is, because, you know, they get into her drug addiction. They obviously touch on gambling addiction. There's a ton of addiction here, and winning is one of them. I want to hone on all those points you just made, Kelsey, were incredible. But
yes.
One of my favorite ones was that is it more important to win or is it more important for them to lose? And I think that's the thing about player X that is makes him suck so bad, is that it is about them losing. It's about him. He even says it. He's like, he's like, I want to destroy people's lives. Like, yeah, this
like,
is
I don't
what
like I winning. I like destroying people's lives.
I like that destroying is, lives. Oof. And like, oof, oof, Maron, that's bad. Like, that is, he a mess. You need therapy. And I don't know if that's Toby, but Toby, if you're listening, maybe you need therapy. But yeah, that was pretty gnarly. And I do think it's great. Like, what a great call out about like Harlan's arc being such an allegory for the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And for her, because you're right, she has that exact moment of where she crosses the line. And you can see where that dealer like kind of put the fear of God into her.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like she was almost bullied into that. But then once she did it, it was like, we broke the seal, you know, it's too late. Mm-hmm. We're kind of down this road already. And I think that's, yeah, it leads to her downfall. It's crazy.
It is interesting to see. And again, this is where that whole thing that I said at the beginning of the personal bias in telling your own story, where obviously you're perfect in everything that you do. She does call herself out a couple times, but I did find that a little strange of how she like doesn't want to take the rake and she's left, you know, $2 million out on the street in her debt sheet, but she doesn't want to hire bad guys to hurt anybody. And I just, is she that naive? Is she really that pure? That was the thing that didn't.
I don't think naive and pure are the same thing.
Well, I'm asking, it's two different questions. So is she naive? Question one. Is she that pure where she's like, well, I just want everybody to have a good time, but I also want to make money, but I don't want to like anybody to get hurt.
That's an interesting question. I don't think she's naive. I think she has learned a lot over the course of this experience. She may have started naive, right? Like in her first, like, oh, I'll just do this for a couple years and save some money and whatever. Like that version of her, I think, had some naivete to her. But I think she has slowly learned so much and gotten really in the thick of this world that, no, you couldn't really say that. But I also don't think you can say that she's pure, even though she has those pure motives about those specific things. Like I think what they're trying to show about her is that she has a line, right? Like she is not perfect. She has definitely broken these laws. She definitely has problems, but she has a line of, I'm not trying to hurt other people in this process. This is about me being great at something, me making money, me running my business, which I have a note about her later of how proud she is of her poker empire when he's trying to defend her as a cocktail waitress. And she's like, you're not going to make it look like I didn't do this. I fucking did this. Mm-hmm. I built this business on my back and I am a badass because of it. And I think it's pride for her. Like it is pride that she did this, even though it doesn't turn out well. She does make a mistake. She does cross a line. But I think where you see her cross a line isn't about hurting anybody.
Would you go as far to say, and Kelsey, you could take this one if you want, that a woman must have a code? Do you think that plays? I'm sorry, I just needed to make another Wire reference. So that may be part of it.
I think everyone has a code, women included. Idris Elba, you inspired us with The Wire this ep. Love it.
I feel like we didn't give enough love to Bad Brad. He was my favorite part of the movie for the 20 or so minutes he was in it. Thought he was very entertaining, and I just love how ignorant he is, and he's the sucker at the table, and even when she sits him down and has the little heart-to-heart trying to talk him out of it, I thought Bad Brad was quite entertaining.
I think he's entertaining, but I don't think he's that much of a sucker. You know,
no.
I think he's intentionally a sucker. Like, he
just wants to be there. And
he's just trying to scheme. Mingle. You know what I mean? He's not there to win poker. He's there to win other things, you know?
His hustle was different.
Right. He had a different hustle.
He was hustling for their side pots, trying to get their cash to put in his Fugazi hedge fund. And that's he ends up rolling on Molly, like, and that's kind of what then, you know, it was the catalyst for all of the spiral and investigation.
Okay, so maybe that's something that I did see. I mean, obviously I watched that scene where they show him getting arrested and all that, but I didn't pick up on that was part of his entire strategy this whole time. So that makes sense thinking about it.
Yeah, and that's based off of a real guy. That part is true. Like there was a guy who flipped on her and he actually was like scamming the players. And he's based, I think it's a Rudderman, Bradley Rudderman was a hedge fund guy. and he had like taken a lot of celebrities through these poker games, and that's how it like kind of got a little bit famous. But yeah, that's been his hustle at the table, is he's just trying to get their investment, and then he scams them out of their investment as well. So he's not great, but he plays it very well. I'll give you that. The actor does a really good job of, like, you know, being that almost levity in those scenes too, where there's not a ton of levity at that time, for sure.
Yeah. So it's one of my, whenever they're picking on financial guys and it's like, you all thought they were worth so much money, but they only had $762 in their bank account. And it's like, they always really lowball that number, like in movies, to just make you feel like, yeah, sucker.
Yeah. I mean, I'm doing great. That guy only had $762.
Yeah. And spinning off of that a little bit, of sort of some of the inconsistencies, which you're always going to get with sort of a true story. And even if it's based on a book, obviously we have some of those in here of like, I don't think that Molly was actually hit by the government or the IRS for nearly as much money as they, I don't know why they felt the need to make the number higher in the movie. Like, I don't know how much more dramatic, say, 4 million is than 2 million. Like, that still seems like a lot to me, but I'm not rich, so who knows. The only thing that bugged me in the inconsistencies, I didn't enjoy how Idris Elba's character is reading her autobiography to sort of help build this case. And that's how he makes this decision to defend her. He's pressing her on, why didn't you give up any names? Why did you do it in this case? Why aren't you willing to flip now? And all these things. And he's channeling into the book. And the fact of it is that the book didn't even come out until after her final trial, where this, you know, lawyer that he's playing had already defended her. So cinema does that. We want to make dress up the story a little bit. But if I'm going to critique Cool Runnings, I'm also going to critique Molly's Game. Sorry.
Which was also a terrible decision. Anyway, moving right along. I think he does that in this movie more, like you said, where that's a movie thing to make it kind of about the book. But I do think it's notable that he decides to defend her before he figures out the name thing, though, because he does decide to defend her based on the debt sheet, which I think, again, speaks quite a bit to her character more than almost anything else, right? Of like, she has all this money, like she is portrayed as being basically destitute at this point, and she chooses not to cash in even though she is quote unquote entitled to that money. And you can tell she does feel entitled to that money, right? Because she has said multiple times, the majority of the money that I made was legitimate. I only took a rake the last 6 months, so I had earned a ton of money before that. And so I think you do see that she feels entitled to that money, but she still doesn't go after it because she knows the risks for it. And I think that's really the crux of why he's Team Molly. All right, homies. Wow. This is a lot in a short period of time. Do we have any final thoughts on Molly's Game? Miss Molly Bloom, poker princess.
What did y'all think of the ending?
I thought the movie wasn't long enough, so they were like, we have to get it to 220, so we're going to have the judge read all 87 questions he has to ask her in the script. So I did laugh at that. With, just like, oh, they're actually going to have all 87.
With voiceover of her explaining what's happening. It's just like,
I do think they went a little far with the voiceover in this one, yeah.
The bumpers were up for us, like for all of you people who don't know, this is how this works. It's like, all right, I got it. Okay, thank you. Thanks, Aaron.
Oh, it's totally true. They did. I think they did go a little bit extra on the voiceover at the end there. But I think overall, I really enjoy this film, and I like their dynamic, and I like how it ends. It does become a little bit sad that you don't feel like you actually get that much resolution from her, or like for her rather. She gets the sentence, and it's, you know, it's bad and whatever. But what is she going to do after this? I think that was like my overarching question at the end of this, right? Of like, what does she do with her life after all this has happened? And she's lived this whole kind of wild and crazy life, right? Like, not just money wise, but like intrigue and adrenaline and all these things that she went through. What is she going to do after that? That's going to be satisfying for somebody who is as competitive and perfectionist like herself. That was kind of my thing at the end.
Yeah, I think for me, I felt some resolution in the ending. It almost seemed a little too happy. If she gets off in the hero, she's having dinner with her family and everything's hunky dory again. But no, I think what we're led to believe, and again, maybe there's some bias in this, but it seems like she's going to succeed at whatever the hell she tries to do next, right? That's sort of what we're to take from this, is that whatever she sets her mind to, she's, because of the way that she's characterized of being competitive, being driven, being independent, which it, alone are great, you know, great qualities, put them all together and you have somebody who's probably going to do well at anything they try. So I thought it was a pretty happy ending, and I'm glad that they had, I keep saying Idris Elba just because he's so damn handsome, but what's the actual lawyer's name? Charlie. The way they have Charlie give that rousing speech of trying to make sense to the prosecution of why she does not deserve any of the, not maybe not doesn't deserve any of this, but does not deserve what they're trying to do to her, and pointing out how unfair the American justice system is, which we already know, and how they try to exploit all these things. So you get a little lesson or reminder of that in this, but I like that they did have his speech pay off in some capacity. She doesn't get found innocent, but she pleads guilty, which I thought was, I did not expect that to happen, but she kind of gets let off light based on what the prosecution was trying to do. So I felt pretty, I guess, relieved at the end. And I felt like it was the happiest ending you were going to get, honestly, for somebody who did break the law.
Yeah, he got her a good deal for sure.
I thought the judge was great. The judge just basically waves his wand. And I loved how she's like, as if he was just reading off the lunch menu. He said, yeah, this isn't a real thing. And he even says, he's like, I look over at Wall Street and they're committing more heinous crimes by lunch.
Your crime's not as bad as these people.
So you go. It's like, what is this? Like, what's going on here? Like, why?
Yeah,
like,
but Kelsey, this is as somebody who made a reference earlier, this is just 600 points to Gryffindor again.
Yeah,
like, it's just, right. We need a better ending, so yeah. Let's just throw this in here.
I don't understand how these point systems work here in New York law. He props this, like, yeah, you're recommending way, way more than I would ever do because these other people are doing far worse things. And it just lets her go, you know, seemingly like off scot-free, right? Which is just like, cool. But like, what?
I think that the argument that he's trying to make is she's in this RICO indictment with a bunch of actual mobsters who have actually murdered and killed people and beat people up, and some of whom have assaulted her, you know? I think it's at that point in this case, I think it's all relative is maybe what it is, right? Maybe that judge is like, you maybe he agrees with the lawyer, right? Of like, you don't even belong in this indictment. This is child's play compared to what everything else is that's happening here. But yeah, it is kind of weird that she gets such a good deal and just, yeah, kind of rides off into the sunset with her family.
I think it's not that she gets the good deal that bothers me. I think it's, Kelsey, what you said of like his logic behind it is what's questionable, because even if you say she's in this RICO indictment with all these terrible people, the logic of the prosecution is, well, she could help us put a bunch of murderers and criminals behind bars if she gives us anything on them. So logically, the judge should still want to, but for his, so if he had just said that of she seems detached from this, I don't believe that she knows anything about this other stuff. She is innocent in that sense. But yeah, him tying it to something completely unrelated. And
yeah,
it's like he loves to spit at Wall Street. I don't know if that's literal and he's just spitting on people, stockbrokers walking in and out of there. It's like,
he was like, how can I get my hatred for Wall Street on the record? Okay, I'll do it in this random as fuck case, right? And then they will know.
Yeah.
It's like, I got a virtue signal where I can in here, people. Yeah.
Can you imagine though? You're like walking into the courthouse and like you're with your lawyer and you see this judge walk by, spits on somebody, and your lawyer is like,
That's our judge.
That's him. He's great. Yeah, he's gonna let you off scot-free. Don't worry.
Yeah, yeah, he hit that Wall Street guy, so he's gonna be in real good mood. Like, what? But no, I agree with you, McKinsey. I do think the punishment fit the crime, which is like, okay, good, plus one for how it nets out there. And to Lamar's point, yeah, spot on. I was nitpicking the like logic behind that of,
yeah,
it seems like you're ruling about something else here, bud. Like, everything okay at home? I got what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she had already lost, what, $4 million, according to the movie, $4 million.
Oh, yeah.
That seems like punishment enough for the rake that she was taking from this game, you know? For
yeah, again, months. It doesn't seem like she took that much after all. I mean, it obviously is going to be hard to get those numbers in any real amount, right? But clearly she hadn't been doing that for that long. And I think at least the way they portrayed in the film is not just greed. It's more, I can't cover this game. I can't run this business. But I think there's an element to this that they don't touch on, which is, I think, that this is partially greed, right? Like, of course, she's a perfectionist and she's competitive and all these things, and we can agree on all of that. But, like, let's be honest, this bitch made $3,000 in one night the first time and she was hooked, right? Like, this started with money and I think ultimately ends with money, right? Like, she had her own parameters to it and she wanted to be the best at it if she was going to do it. But what motivated her to start was quick cash, right? Yeah. And I just think that that was... I think that was really overlooked in the film. That is one critique that I will definitely give it of. We don't even touch on that. We don't even act like that could possibly be why she's motivated to do this. Everything that she's doing that's fancy or high end or whatever is presented in a way that it's for the game, right? It's not about her own personal material needs and greed. It's about this driving this game forward. And I just think it's so much about money.
That's a good point, Mackenzie, because then I wonder if maybe it's intentional of the direct of Sorkin when he's writing this script of, is she not self-aware enough to realize that she is flawed in that way, where she is greedy and maybe she is doing these things really because she wants to have better clothes. You know, she talks, they make a big deal of, oh, this dress, the one she's wearing at the beginning, she spent $80 on at JCPenney. Now she went and bought this fancy ass dress for her first big poker night, whatever it might be, second big poker night. So I think that maybe she's meant to be a little self-aware in that way. And then the only other thing I wanted to say was I referenced Wolf of Wall Street earlier, and I know they're I don't want to put them on the same level because I think the one is obviously much more criminal and douchey than the other. But when you were talking about the money and how competitive she is, it reminds me of that line in Wolf of Wall Street where I can't remember the exact number, but he says, oh, last year I made this many millions of dollars and I got really pissed off because it was this far away from being a million a week or something like that. That's what I think he and Molly actually have more in common. Their moral code is different, but I think they're driven by the same sort of drivers.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's competitiveness, but it's money driven primarily. And also, like, spoiler alert, after this, I don't know how much more she's done really, like, other than promote this book. Mm-hmm. And also she has a podcast now. Everybody's got podcasts. Listen to these folks. But what the fuck is a podcast? What are these people doing with their lives? But she definitely has a podcast that it's called Torched. And it's about like competitive stories, like competitive winners and like athletes who have been in these really high intensity careers and whatnot. I haven't heard it, but I just know that she's done it because I did follow her at some point after this film had come out and was just trying to see what she was up to. And yeah, she was mostly still promoting this film for a long time. And then she definitely gives an air of wanting the nicer, finer things and wanting to be wealthy and like being materialistic to some degree on her Instagram even. So I think again that's part of it that they don't really touch on here that I think is true about the person maybe from the little bit that I've seen.
Yeah, I had that's interesting to know, but I had one unrelated thing that I really wanted to ask you about, Mackenzie. And Kelsey, feel free to weigh in if you feel qualified. There's a few lines of dialogue in this that felt, I don't even know if it would be vaguely feminist, but I found them interesting that they had a couple lines where she points out this world run by men, these poker, you know, they're little frat boys. And obviously a lot of this dates back to the way her dad treated her, the way her dad treated her mom. I think that's where we're meant to think it comes from. What did you read out of that? Because I'm curious to get a female perspective on, do you think that that's what the director's trying to get across, is it's a feminist movie, or was that just tied into her youth?
I don't know that that's what he's trying to get across. I think maybe it's a byproduct of this story, right? Of this woman takes this thing and is a badass and runs with it, even though she makes mistakes. But no, I didn't read the whole story as an especially feminist narrative. No. And I, not to say that she's not an independent feminist woman who thinks herself capable of pretty much anything, as she clearly is and should believe she can be. But I don't think that was the overarching narrative. I don't think, and I definitely don't think it was about her overcoming this world, like breaking that glass ceiling in the poker world for women. Like, I don't think she had anyone else in mind but herself. And I don't think it had anything to do with her own gender. I mean, so I don't read that from this, no.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking through it right now, I mean, it feels yes, I could see the feminist notes to it, but it probably does ring more like fish out of water, where, yeah, the feminist part of that is in there, but it's, to I think Mackenzie's point too, like bigger than that. It's like, I am proving that to whoever, to myself, that like I belong in an area where it might not seem like I belong. So fish out of water in the poker room, where she's not a celebrity or not a power broker or not of the status that everybody else is, like she's wanting to break into that and, you know, see what that's like.
Yeah. I think you're both right. I think it's probably just a product of circumstance. Like maybe it's not as intentional. I think when you think about her history with her father, and then when you think about how things went with her her boss in LA and player X, it makes sense that when she gets to New York, she's going to recruit an all-female team because she feels like she can sort of trust them, and that's who she brings into her inner circle. So I think it does, it might just be circumstantial, but that's sort of how I was reading it while watching it. But I think talking it through, maybe it's not meant to be as, I guess, obvious.
I mean, I think the great part about any movie at all and a piece of art is that it's open to interpretation. And who knows? Maybe that was intentional. It just, I think she has a different energy about her that maybe dilutes that, if that is part of the point.
Yeah. Is that why you liked Dawn of the Dead last week too? Because it's a piece of art and it's open to interpretation.
Oh, yeah. I was a big fan. Yeah. Super big fan of Dawn of the Dead. Okay. Well, thank you guys both for deep diving on this. I love Aaron Sorkin pretty much everything, so this was really fun for me to have an excuse to rewatch this, and it was fun to introduce you, Lamar, to something you haven't seen before. And of course, super fun to have our guest, Kelsey, here. Thank you so much for coming and for bidding on this. Like, what a cool thing for you to even want to do with us. I think it's super awesome. Thanks for joining.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right, fam, come back next week for our final inaugural episode, which is going to be Goon, which I'm
you're already super thrilled
about, if you couldn't tell from the tone of my voice. Go back
and re-record last week's outro and be like, come back next week, we're watching Molly's Game.
No. See, I have publishing rights, so no, we're not doing that. But we are going to watch Goon next week, for better or fucking worse. All right, but for now...
You haven't even seen it. That's the... Oh, my God.
All I need to see is the preview, the image that, like, the cover, judge a book by its cover, I know is not supposed to be a rule. You can judge a movie by its cover. And that movie cover looks like piping hot garbage. But, hey, I could be proven wrong. I haven't seen it yet. We're going to find out. But for now, go... have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers.